Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Have you ever found yourself in a conversation with a friend or a family member and heard, "I get that you believe what you believe. The thing is, if there was enough proof, I would too. So cough up, convince me." Pastor, historian and author David Robertson has collected the most asked questions of a believer in his experience and sets about sharing his proofs that Jesus is great. David, fantastic to meet you. Thank you for your time. In your book, Magnificent Obsession, you lay out your evidences of the greatness of Jesus in a really methodical, intentional way. Every chapter, in fact, starts with the letter M. We'll explore that in a few moments' time. Did you have anyone specifically in mind when you began writing this book?
Yeah. Well, the first book I did was a response to Richard Dawkins, though I was really writing for non-Christians who would read Dawkins and then possibly read this. This one, what I did was I basically invented a character we called I called Jay, and Jay's kind of not real, as I say in the book. He's,
yeah,
unlike Jesus, he's not real, but or she's not real. But Jay is a kind of composite of loads of people I meet. I mean, every single question that I answer in the book is a question that I've personally been asked. I would say who I had in mind are basically people who've got questions about Jesus and are just not sure about a whole load of stuff. They're probably people who are fairly literate. You know, not massively academic or anything like that. It's a fairly straightforward book, but who think and who are obviously part of, I would say, Western culture. You know, because there's a lot of cultural references in there as well.
David, in the Jesus the Man chapter, you examine the virgin birth. Is this a question you're asked a lot? The value of a virgin birth?
Yeah, the reason it's important for lots of non-Christians is, it's what Tim Keller calls a defeater belief straight away. They go, no, you know, virgins don't have children. And it's important, I mean, I, as a Christian, I think there's a theological importance, but for a non-Christian, I think the whole idea of the miraculous. Now, if you start off with the view that there is no supernatural, there is no God, therefore there can be no supernatural, you're automatically going to say the virgin birth didn't happen. If you're a little bit more open-minded, you're going to say, okay, well, what's the big deal about that? And I think it's really, really important to who Jesus is, that he was human, he was absolutely human, but was without sin. And that is that's the key aspect for me of the virgin birth.
You dedicate a chapter to miracles, David. Are they a proof or a catalyst to faith in your view?
Yeah, I mean, well, I point out that you've got lots of Christians who say, oh yeah, we see miracles all the time. But first of all, you've got to define what a miracle is. You know, my teenage daughter gets out of bed at 8 o'clock in the morning and she comes down and I go, hey, that's a miracle. And no, it's not. You know, there are lots and lots of things that happen. You pray for someone to get better and they get better and we don't know if it's a miracle or not. But miracles in the biblical sense are extraordinary events which occur, you know, supernaturally. I think they're a lot less common than a lot of Christians claim. I think in the Bible, there are three basic periods, Moses, Elijah and Elisha, and Jesus and the apostles, where there are lots of miracles. I happen to believe that God still does miracles today, but they're a lot rarer than people would say.
And to what extent should they be a proof for a contemporary Christian that God exists?
I would say evidence rather than proof. It's almost impossible to prove anything. It depends which the way which you start. When someone starts off thinking, well, miracles don't happen, then they're not going to see any miracles, really. And if someone starts off, well, I see miracles every single day, they're going to find them everywhere. My view is that, I mean, I'm a historian as well as being a minister, and I kind of look at the evidence for the miracles of Jesus and I go, it's pretty powerful evidence. At a personal level, a couple of years ago, I was very, very seriously ill. I was in an high dependency unit, an ICU unit in the hospital. I was not expected to live. People all over the world prayed, including in Australia. My daughter's in Australia. Somebody flew her back here basically to be at my deathbed. And I recovered. And my surgeon, who was a Muslim, said in 30 years, he'd only ever met two people he would regard as miracles. He said, I was one of them. So I have a personal interest in this as well.
I can imagine.
Yes, I think it's important. But for me, it's important that the miracles show who Jesus is, not that they stop me dying. I think we have to be really careful how we do our definitions. I mean, in the book, I quote C.S. Lewis's definition about it being an extraordinary event, completely out of the ordinary. You know, like the resurrection, for example, which is the greatest miracle of all. It's sometimes my atheist friends will go, yeah, because people were stupid in those days and they all believed the people rose from the dead. And you're going, no, the one reason they stopped listening to Paul in Athens is when he started talking about the resurrection from the dead. I mean, goodness me, the disciples, even after they'd met Jesus, still doubted whether it really happened.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, not just Thomas. Yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary.
You use a word in your book I don't hear often enough, and when I saw it, I smiled immediately, and that is you decree the marvelousness of Jesus, and you tie it to this time of the year in Easter, and the marvelousness of a resurrection, and I thought, why don't we use that word more often?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely, because it's stunning. I mean, my wife works as a social worker, and very few of her colleagues, if any, are believers. And one of them in particular is a very, very wonderful, lovely person, very intelligent atheist. And she took the book, read it, and she came to me and she said, do you know, there's one thing that really bothers me. So I need to ask you this. I said, what's that? She said, do you really, really believe that Jesus is alive today, that he's alive now? And I said, yes, I do. She said, that's incredible. She said, that changes everything. That's a complete game changer. And, you know, I thought she actually got the wonder of it. I mean, she was looking at me. She couldn't work out whether I was mad or not. and for her, it was just a complete... Now, I think as Christians, far too often we're blasé about things. They're like doctrines, you know, Jesus is alive, yeah, sure. Jesus died for our sins, yeah, sure. You know, let's go on with the important stuff. And you go, no, this is completely mind-blowing. It's completely stunning. It's completely wonderful. If Jesus is alive, everything's changed. Easter Sunday, I don't often do this, but I'll be doing it this year. I'll be doing an apologetic sermon, basically the chapter from the book, because we've got a lot of non-Christians started coming to our church, and people from many cultures. And for all of them, if Jesus is alive, if Jesus rose from the dead, everything's changed. And it's not that I'm proving it to them. I'm showing them the evidence. And actually, part of the evidence is that I believe. Because they'll look and go, you seem quite sane.
Yeah.
You know, you seem quite intelligent. People really believe this? They're not just kind of redneck hillbillies who believe this, but, you know, not just people from way out in the outback or whatever, or up in the highlands, or, you know, they'll come into the church and there's loads of young people, and we've got doctors, we've got, you know, farm workers, we've got everything. And they go, you people really believe this? And it's not that we believe it, it's changed our life. And that's an incredible evidence, actually.
Which I guess brings us to the next M chapter in your book, David, that is the mission of the church. It's this time of the year where we start to see our numbers swell with one or two time visitors. And inevitably, at some point in our conversations, either this time of the year or elsewhere, we'll hear the question, why would you bother going to church? Sure, believe in God, but what's the point of church in 2014?
Well, you can gather from the book, I like alliteration.
So yes.
In terms of mission, the fascinating thing is at the beginning of Acts, Luke says all that Jesus began to do and teach. And his previous book, Luke, he's saying this is what Jesus began to do and teach. The whole implication is that Acts is not really the Acts of the apostles. It's the Acts of Jesus Christ through the apostles, through the church. And the work of Jesus continues. And the mission of the church is the same as the mission of Jesus. It's to proclaim the kingdom. It's to save people. It's to bring people into relationship with God. It's to fit them and prepare them for heaven. And it's all the fruits of that and the side effects of that. The primary mission of the church is to glorify and proclaim and exalt Jesus Christ.
David, in this same mission chapter, you touch on the violence of some people who believe, and it's a defense for those who maintain that if there were no gods, there would perhaps be no wars, citing the Crusades, for instance.
Oh, yeah. I hear it all the time. I mean, usually it's from people who are largely historically ignorant. It's just it's one of these rumors and, you know, caricatures of which there's an element of truth. But what people, there was a poll done by the Guardian newspaper in Britain in 2007, and the majority of people thought the number one cause of evil in the world was religion. Christopher Hitchens, the book is in part a response to Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great. And he would often cite the argument that in the world there are good people and bad people, that good people do good things, bad people do bad things, but for good people to do bad things, it takes religion. And everything gets lumped together. My atheist friends will say things like, atheists don't fly planes into buildings, to which my response is, neither do Presbyterians, nor even charismatics, you know. But they lump everything together, you know, so religious terrorist, religious this. And so I don't often hear about the Crusades, but that will be brought up as part of an overwhelming thing. You know, watch out, your suicide bombers are religious. You know, I mean, I'm a minister, but I don't wear a dog collar or anything like that. But if I wanted a seat on a train in Britain all to myself, I'd just put a dog collar on, you know. Though knowing my luck, I'd get the one other religious nutter who wanted to come and ask the end times or something, you know.
Okay, I was delighted to see you address one of the very common questions that is directed at me is, if Christ existed, and I'm willing to accept that he did, it was way back then.
Well, part of that comes back to Jesus being alive. Part of it comes being to God being eternal. Part of it is to simply say, yeah, they keep telling us about the death of God. It just hasn't happened. The reason Richard Dawkins wrote The God Delusion is because Christianity and Islam and Judaism are so popular. Even in Europe, I mean, it's very interesting that The Economist magazine in its Millennium Edition 2000 published an obituary for God. It's over, it's done with. In 2007, they published a 16-page apology entitled God Returns to Europe. You know, the whole concept of religion going to die, it's not. Christianity in particular is not going to die. The gates of hell will not prevail against Christ's church. But at a personal level, if someone said that to me personally, I would just simply say, because of who you are. Because you are not just chemicals. Because you do have a spirit, you do have a soul, because you were made in the image of God and you were made for God. And as Augustine put it, our hearts were made for thee and they're restless until they find their rest in thee. So I'll quote the Rolling Stones at them as well as Augustine. You know, you can't get no satisfaction.
David, toward the end of your book in the Maranatha section, you touch on the nature of God. And a common question, regardless of whether we are searching for answers or just looking to defend a position, is if God is love, he created man with the power of choice and, knowing that they would possibly fail, actually created a hell. What kind of God is that?
Yeah, people ask questions for two reasons. There are people who ask questions that want to... It's not a question, it's an accusation. I mean, I think the favorite question I was ever asked in a meeting was a guy who stood up and said, why are you such an idiot? He wasn't inquiring after my mental well-being, you know. On the other hand, there are people who ask questions because they're genuine questions. They really do want to know. When someone says something like that, I try and work out, okay, where are you coming from? You're just making an accusation. Now, for me, it's a huge question, and I spent a lot of time, and it's only about a year ago, I started doing this lecture on the apologetic of evil using St. Augustine. But I would say to people something very simple. I said, you know, if I was God, I could have created you so that you never experienced any pain, you never had any broken relationships, you never had any illness, you never had any existential angst or worry. Would you like that? And they would say, yeah, how would you do it? I said, dead simple. I'd make you into a chair. Because that chair you're sitting on doesn't feel anything, doesn't worry about the meaning of life, doesn't... And it's a very simple point. And you can stretch it too far, but the bottom line is just simply this. If you're going to be human, to be human, it means that you have to be able to love. To be able to love means that you've got to have someone to love, and you've got to have some kind of choice. You can't choose good if there's only good to choose. You know, and I think what God has done is he's created the best of all possible worlds in which humanity was able to be human. And he's also, when that world fell, he also put into place a plan whereby that world and the universe would be redeemed. And then that's how you come back to Jesus.
Which brings us, David, to that last chapter in your book, The Magnificence of Jesus and the Plan of Salvation. And you observe that salvation actually comes about, in a way, due to the combination of different kinds of knowledge. What's that combination made up of?
Well, we have knowledge that you get through your head, obviously. You know, intellectually you work things through. But all of us have knowledge that comes from experience, kind of intuition and so on. I would also argue that there is knowledge that comes from revelation, though usually that comes through your head as well. So I'm saying that none of us know things absolutely. I mean, we all have different perspectives and different experiences. Now, your postmodernist is going to say, yes, that means you can really know nothing, which I don't believe. So I think our knowledge comes from experience, from our senses, from the mind. We are logos. We are reasonable, rational creatures. We're made in the mind, in the image of God. And I think that's very important, particularly when you're dealing with the new atheists, because they tend to have this attitude, which I think is really quite funny, that they say, we are rational and reasonable. And you're going, no, actually, the early Christian apologists argued entirely that the Christian faith was rational and reasonable. And I think it is. I think the new atheism, their motto is, there is no God and I hate him, which is not rational or reasonable. You know, it's an emotional reaction. Right? Yeah. I was speaking at Cambridge University once, and this man stood up, turned out to be a lecturer, and I'd been talking about how the new atheists were very emotional and angry, and I get hate mail pretty well every day, certainly every week. I just wrote a piece on the cross and published in the Scotsman newspaper, and immediately got people writing in saying, he's a psychotic liar. Just 'cause I've, you know, so they're very emotional, very, very angry. This man stood up, and when I mentioned this, he stood up and he started yelling at me, what do you mean we're emotional? We're not emotional. What are you talking about, you idiot? And after about 2 minutes, I was standing there going, thank you, Lord, the place is packed. And one of his friends says, sit down, you fool, and shut up. You've just proved his point. And he came up to me at the end and apologized and said, I kind of handed that to you on a plate. And I said, yeah, you did, thanks.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. You know, and there's that, it's very interesting. Don't let people buy into this thing about we're rational, intelligent, modern, scientific, empirical evidence people. That's why we're atheists. No, that's not the case. And I people say, why are you a Christian? I say, because it's true.
David Robertson, there is much more that I'd love to cover with you, but can I ask you one question just to put a lid on what's been a fascinating conversation? And that is, when you rise to the pulpit this Easter, what is it you're most passionate that people who come to hear you speak understand?
That Jesus is alive and that he's alive for them, that he's dead for them, that he died for them, and that he's alive for them, and that he invites them to come to himself, and that he will never, never turn away anyone who comes to him. If I can just show them something of the beauty and the wonder of Jesus, that for me will be sufficient.
David, happy Easter.
And you, happy Easter.